So many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello and welcome to Geekily Yoked, the world's best married Christian geek podcast, Valentine's edition. I'm Lehman Kessler.
I'm Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Rachel Kessler.
Indeed. I'm a priest here in the Anglican Diocese of Toronto and a PhD in medieval literature, which makes me a giant nerd.
I'm a stay-at-home dad who used to sell books to people, and I'm a giant dork.
And I'm having wine tonight, so if my speech is a little slurred, forgive me.
Yeah, this will be your first sort of real drink in how long?
A long time. No, I mean, I've had some drinks since the baby was born.
Yeah.
I've just been like uber careful around.
You have been very, very careful. You've been the anti-madman mother.
But now that she has like a predictable bedtime and we can be relatively certain she won't wake up for like another 4.5 hours, I realize this is like prime drinking time.
It is prime drinking time. That's true. This is sort of my prime just sort of do things time, I find. Like, aside from the fact that like from 8 to midnight is sort of when I am holding her. Nevertheless,
yeah, we need to fix that.
Nevertheless, it's sort of when I'm at my most awake sort of naturally. So I'm like, I could do things. I should like have people over. I should like do a thing. But it's like randomly like the middle of the night. And we can't have anyone over from like 6 to 8 because that's very delicate negotiations with sleeping.
It's true.
So it does make things tricky.
But at least we have a sort of kind of rhythm.
We have something.
Sort of kind of. And you the dog is crying downstairs.
You have your strange like unguents that you sort of slather her in. But I sort of understand, but it's very strange. It is baby massage. It is good. I'm going to have weird like paternal associations with lilacs going out or whatever, like that lavender, whatever the goop you smear all over her smells like. Because seriously, like I smell that, I'm like, baby. That is the smell of like infancy. It's going to do weird things to my reptile brain.
Right. So what have you been up to?
Well,
aside from being confused by baby massages.
By your unguents. I managed to actually succeed in leaving the house with her by myself.
You did. You went on a daddy-daughter adventure.
We went, I found a bunch of board gamers. I had this idea in my head, because I'm not going to find, like, I mean, I may find, like, mommy groups or something, but, like, I don't know. I don't want to sit around in a coffee shop and talk about...
Aren't mommy groups typically, like, really suspicious of stay-at-home dads anyway?
They did talk about that. The only like thing I've ever seen about like mommy and daddy and sort of playgroups and things is from a really disturbing movie called Little Children. So board games was, I found a group of that actually their mandate was they were looking for folks who are unemployed.
Oh, really?
Or students, or generally are free from like 12 to 5 to kind of hang out, and you were just in.
So who hosts it?
It's, I feel like I might have like met this person at Snakes and Lattes.
Which the Toronto is the geek scene is not
huge. Well, it's big, but it's.
But yeah. I mean, it is a fairly like.
It's contained, and the fact is, the board game society, I think, or board game culture would have to be also fairly fairly contained. But there, we have a board game cafe here in Toronto, and it was the first board game cafe I'd ever heard of. But I think they're sort of sprouting up. Essentially, you pay a cover. And you go in, and they have a huge collection of board games, and you play, and you buy coffee or food, and you just hang out. And it's pretty cool. And for a while, I don't know if they have it anymore, but they used to have staff just wandering around to teach you how to play.
Oh, that's cool.
And I feel like...
I've still never been to Snakes and Lattes. I don't really know how that's happened.
Well, the problem with Snakes and Lattes is it's sort of an event. Like, you sort of, I feel like you have to plan with, get folks together and go down.
Yeah.
It's not like...
Hey, we'll just drop by and,
yeah, and
get a latte and...
Well, and because you're paying, you know, you're paying the cover, so you feel like, oh, I need to be here for a certain amount of time. Yes. And so if you have made those arrangements and you're like, all right, we're getting together, like folks are getting together for kind of a quasi-birthday get-together.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that helps.
Wasn't there a period of time when it had like a line, like you had a queue to get in as well?
Yeah. No, it was a bit, I mean, I don't think I've ever been there when it's been empty. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
It's a pretty hopping place, which is very exciting. But luckily, well, actually, this girl's place was pretty huge, too. There were about 11 folks there, I think, altogether, and another 6-month-old. So that was nice. Amanda was not the only crying, pooping creature. But it was good for me to be able to get the opportunity to you know, take her out and,
yes.
and negotiate subways. And,
and for me to let you take her out.
Yes. And I sort of fed her. I presented her with the option of eating.
I think what we found is she'll eat when she's hungry.
Yes. I don't understand how babies are opposed to both sleeping and eating.
Yeah, no, they're the worst.
It's just... And the fact that they get too sleepy to sleep and too hungry to eat, it's just the worst.
And if you put them to bed later, they wake up earlier. I don't get it.
Ugh, it's terrible.
I know.
So we're here to talk about love.
Oh, I have to say, I watched Orphan Black.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
How was that?
Canadian.
Yes, very
excessively Canadian.
Yeah.
For those of you who have not heard of Orphan Black, because you do not live in... The True North, Strong and Free, where...
Or have the space network.
The Canadian version of the Sci-Fi Channel. Orphan Black is a delightful little 10-episode, or first season's 10-episode, sci-fi conspiracy thriller, which made most news for not making Emmy news.
Yes.
It got like, tons of buzz because the lead actress was not nominated for an Emmy, because she's starring in a... tiny Space Channel original series programming in Canada. So, of course, she was not nominated for an Emmy.
Well, it's funny because the show's sort of... It gives a kind of Dollhouse clone feel, but everything I've heard is that it's much better.
Well, it's darker, which is odd given the premise of Dollhouse.
Well, bleh.
But it is a clone show. So the... I mean, which I guess is sort of giving something away that's revealed.
I feel like you figure that out pretty soon.
If you can't figure, if you know that it's a sci-fi show and you can't figure it out after the first scene, why are you even bothering? Anyway, so it's a clone show, and the lead actress plays at this point, I think, 6 or 7 versions of herself.
Yeah,
at least 4 that I would consider principal characters.
Okay,
and it is amazing. I'd heard that her performance was really phenomenal, and I will grant that it took me a couple of episodes to really...
Get into it?
Well, get past the, like, excessive consciousness that this is the same actress.
Oh,
and, like, kind
saying.
Of looking for how she's trying to differentiate these characters, right? So it took me a couple of episodes to kind of just stop seeing that.
Get past the sort of acting exercise of it all?
Yeah, get past the acting exercise. But once you do, it is... It's phenomenal. Like, her performance is not overstated.
And is there anyone in it who's, like, a sort of recognized face or
Max
name?
Hedrum?
Oh, Matt
Ford? You haven't gotten to him yet.
I have not. I've only watched the first episode. I see. It's I should think of him as Max Hedrum, except I've never seen Max Hedrum, so I'll always think of him as either...
The guy in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
Well, the mean dad from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, or the time-traveling con artist from that one episode of Next Generation.
Ah, okay. Yeah, it's amazing to watch this woman play these different characters.
Yeah.
And the special effects when they're in shots together.
Yeah, no, it is very impressive.
I guess if I knew more about graphic design or something, I would see the seams. But as far as it is, it's pretty seamless.
Yeah, no, the visual effects are very...
It is amazing. And by about 4 episodes in, you honestly forget that it's one woman playing these different characters. And you just think that it's this ensemble cast. And you're like, oh, right. Because even if she were just playing the one, like, kind of point of view clone, the one we sort of start with,
the main character,
even if she was just playing Sarah, she would have a pretty big job.
Oh, yeah.
But then she's playing...
A bunch of others.
Again, like, what I would consider 3 other principal characters.
Okay.
It is phenomenal.
And
not only that, there are scenes where the clones impersonate each other. And you like she even distinguishes that performance.
That's really cool.
It's pretty phenomenal. So if you're able, I would encourage you to check out. I don't really know.
Well, you if just it's grabbed on, you sort of.
Well, I just I had iTunes. Well, I had iTunes gift cards for, and I had randomly because it was made for the Space Network.
Yes,
but CTV was running it as well, and I just randomly caught like. Episode 6 or something like that.
Okay.
Last spring, and was intrigued enough. It's the one where the clone who is the like really super uptight housewife
from Mississauga or Scarborough.
Scarborough goes, like, finally snaps.
Nice.
And her arc is one of a really dark comedy.
Okay.
So you have that to look forward to.
Yes, indeed.
So that was what I did this past week when in bouts of Amanda sleeping or not sleeping or whatever it is she does.
She exists. And she exists.
When trapped under a baby when all I have is my iPad.
There is that. But she exists because of our love.
Okay, is that the segue we have going on here?
And I think it's time we talk about love.
It is Valentine's Day.
It is Valentine's Day.
And I was, this was mostly inspired by me being on Facebook and seeing IO9's post about like the top 10 worst romances in science fiction. And I was like, oh, hey, we should talk about love.
We did just,
we have to podcast tonight.
We did just finish or eat part of a heart-shaped cake.
We did.
Because we're classy like that.
It's true. Sitting on the floor of our daughter's nursery trying to keep her from waking up.
Well, it's very important.
Ironically, she'd wake up much more easily if we left.
Well, that is true. So, yes, we're going to talk about some of our favorite couples.
Some of our least favorite couples.
Some of our least favorite couples. we were watching an episode of Deep Space Nine tonight.
Aww.
As we are slowly making our way through season 7.
Season 7 isn't very good.
And it gets better. It really does. The last three episodes, I think,
okay,
are really good.
Okay. That doesn't count. It gets better is you're watching season 5 of Babylon 5, and you're like, you just have to get through the horrible Byron stuff, and then you get to cool Centauri stuff, and it gets better.
There we go.
Knowing that the last episode is good doesn't mean it gets better. It just means the last episode is okay.
That's very true. And by the last episode being really good, it was really good when I saw it. I don't want to think how many years ago.
Oh, good. Is this like how Heir to the Empire is a good book when you read it at 14?
Oh, man, Heir to the Empire.
Then you try to read it again, and you're like, oh.
That book.
Hot chocolate.
Ooh, bad news. But no, the episode we watched tonight was problematic because it was dealing with Odo and Kira's relationship, which was really good up until they actually got together.
Yeah, I was like, because it's really funny because I watched Deep Space Nine when I was like 14.
Yeah.
I watched it when it was originally on air. But I don't really remember much about it other than the fact that I really wanted to be Jadzia Dax. I had a mild crush on Bashir.
Yeah.
And I really really pined for Odo getting Kira.
Oh, I see.
But I guess I didn't watch it long enough.
To see it happen.
To see it happen and be like, oh.
All right.
I don't like them. They're horrible. It's like, well, they're just awkward.
They don't have great chemistry.
No. They had a really good friend. Like, the Bajorans and the Federation spaced, like, kind of chemistry.
No, they did a lot of fun, you know, early on being the slightly off part of the kind of power structure.
Yeah.
But Kira's also been weird, right? Like,
Kira has her ups and downs. There's times when I love Kira and times when I, like, just can't get past horrible Mirrorverse Kira.
Well, the episode this season with Kira and Dukat, and Dukat's crazy, like,
oh, yeah, cult thing.
Like, cult. Like, that was really, like, that was really good.
I feel like anything with Kira and Dukat is just going to be gold.
Anything with Dukat is generally going to be gold.
But I like that. I like the ebbs and flows of their relationship. Yeah. That it's not just one trajectory anyway. But that it's like it. There's times when they're almost like they go from being mortal enemies to almost friends to back.
They're sort of respecting each other. Yeah. But then like, oh, you did terrible things to my mother, and like, yeah, just sort of keeps going back and forth. But yeah, with Odo and Kira, I think how I put it is they had the kind of the Jim and Pam problem. Of Jim and Pam are interesting up until they get together.
But is it only because at least you buy Jim and Pam as a couple? They kind of become odious and like self-involved terrible people once they get together. But
this will be from the American office for anyone. Yes,
but with Odo and Kira, it's just like you just don't buy the relationship at all. Like, no. Jim and Pam at least still have chemistry.
Well, it got me trying to think if there are any good Star Trek romances.
Ugh.
And I was sort of going back and thinking about, like, Riker and Deanna.
Jadzia and Bashir would have been a great romance if they'd actually let it happen.
But see, that was interesting because he was pining for her. Like they do this sort of interesting unrequited stuff.
But I feel like he was pining for her and it was unrequited, but I feel like had they gotten together, it would have worked.
Mm.
I feel like I would have bought that more than I bought Jadzia and Worf.
Well, Jadzia and Worf was interesting. I'm trying to figure out if I like that. Like, I do. I feel like...
I mean, I can buy it from Jadzia's character, because I feel like she... You could see her kind of going through all those Klingon rituals and, like, falling in love with a Klingon and all of that. Like, you can...
She needed someone strong, and she needed someone, like... And while I do like what Deep Space Nine did with Worf, I think they did a decent job taking Worf's character from Next Gen, the character who just gets told no all the time.
It's funny, because I heard that as a stereotype, and then we were watching Next Gen until they took it off of Netflix, and they really do just tell him no
it's
all the time.
It's a really long supercut out there of telling Worf no. So the Worf and Jadzia thing kind of worked, but again, was not super interesting. I mean,
no.
It was okay. The sort of like the, well, Picard and Vash, like Picard's weird like thief girlfriend was kind of meh wrong. But Picard and Crusher is interesting.
I kind of like,
because it's sort of,
I didn't hate it.
They were kind of the parents of the Enterprise
it's
to
true.
Begin with.
Yes.
Which sort of helped. And they gave them a history that sort of like, you know, started pretty early on. Like Picard, I can't remember if he was like responsible for Crusher's husband's death or if like he was somehow.
It was something like that.
There was some weird tie-in like that. And like.
Was he under Picard's command?
Something like that. And Wesley was like weirdly looking up to him as a father figure, but that didn't really work.
Yeah.
But in like, when they go, when, you know, when. In the final episode, and the All Good Things like okay. sort of like series of episodes, they refer to the fact that they're divorced. That they're like Crusher and Picard are an ex-husband and wife, and they're still like they're still a relationship.
Oh really?
They're still like
they were an ex-husband and wife from before.
No, because parts of All Good Things takes place in the future.
Oh,
sorry,
okay. I have not.
All Good Things takes place in the past, present, and future of Picard.
Oh, good, fun.
So they could do some interesting work with girdles, but they show that they were married, and then
wow.
have subsequently divorced. And I feel like that works for them. Like
I can see that. Yeah,
that they would have tried, and things just wouldn't have worked out. Voyager, I don't care.
We don't even want to go there.
Who knows? Enterprise, but I don't even know. But yeah, but I think I just for whatever reason Star Trek just when it came to like. I mean, there's tons of shippers for Star Trek, right?
Yeah, but Star Trek was not... Well, I think this goes to the heart of the issue, right? Star Trek was not primarily a sort of human saga. It was... There was always something more cerebral about Star Trek.
Well, and also they, you know, with Next Gen especially, Next Gen was so episodic. The idea of, like, creating a relationship...
I mean, I guess we have to at least mention Riker and Troi.
Well,
as,
even,
like, the most established canon romantic relationship in Star Trek.
Sort of... But even that is kind of like...
It's like in the movies later on, right?
I guess. I don't even know.
They get married at one point.
Yeah, well, that's right. And there's like a...
They do.
On like a ship.
Like, isn't it in the terrible one? Generations, I think.
You know what?
No, don't even. No.
Generations.
I'm done. I'm disavowing this conversation.
When was the last time you saw Generations?
I don't know. High school?
See, I saw Generations in college. And I had never seen it, and I'd
this
heard...
is from the one who was like, you should... What's the one with the Borg Queen, which is the... Nemesis?
No. First Contact.
First Contact, yeah, sorry.
But see, I had seen...
And you were like, you should watch... Because we just watched the whole The Cutest of the Borg arc.
Yeah.
And you were like, you should watch First Contact. You can see how this plays out in Picard's psyche. And I did, Lehman. I did sit down to watch that movie one night.
Yeah.
And you were wrong.
Okay, see, but First Contact I haven't seen since high school, okay? So the high school Lehman doesn't know what he's talking about, but I saw Generations because I was one of my Blockbuster rentals when I was working at Blockbusters, and it is not great, but it's not terrible. Malcolm McDowell is
always you always gotta love Malcolm McDowell.
Malcolm McDowell is a Heroes.
Was
I guess
Heroes?
Yes,
I feel like I blocked out most.
He was
of
the dumb like main villain of Heroes. They
thought Siler was the main villain.
No,
of Heroes.
Siler was a dumb butt. No, like the guy behind all like the conspiracies, like trying to bring
okay.
everyone together,
right,
and like
right.
was blah blah blah. See, that's how great a villain he was. Is that you do not remember that he? Was
I
in
just
it.
Don't remember much about Heroes.
But yeah, Malcolm McDowell was not terrible. The whole like weird like world that they go to where Kirk is still alive is not terrible. The fact that Cameron from Ferris Bueller's Day Off was responsible for the, like, for supposedly killing Kirk is
so
kind
anyway,
of amazing.
Anyway, romance in Star Trek is not generally a good thing.
They're not really done very well. No.
Except for unrequited pining.
Except for unrequited pining and, like, bromances between, like, Bashir and Miles.
Oh, Bashir and Miles. Their love is true.
Because Miles and Keiko.
Well, because Keiko is just kind of an absentee wife.
But like, Data and Geordi.
It's true.
You know, I guess Paris and Ensign Kim. I don't know. Why not?
Kirk and Spock. I guess Kirk we have Spock, to. If we're going to mention romances,
so for that, in that regards, they work well. But no, for straight up romances, it doesn't really work. And I'm sort of like now thinking, okay, how about Star Wars? Well, Star Wars did give us Han and Leia, but I feel like they also gave us Amidala and Anakin, and so
and that just like loses, so that it doesn't quite balance out.
It does cancel each other out. I will give honorable mention to 30 seconds worth of beautiful romance of Amidala and Anakin in the Jenny Tartakovsky minisodes, right, where there's no dialogue. Like that made it work, but yeah. So our two big pillars of our fandom
are not. I mean, Han and Leia is a pretty great romance.
It's pretty decent.
I mean, it's well built up. I mean, it's clear that she was sort of intended for Luke originally. Whoops.
Yeah.
But as it was, it they had great chemistry.
Yeah. They're both on a lot of drugs, which I'm sure helped.
I'm sure they were both. Was Harrison Ford on a lot of drugs? I mean, it was the 80s, so you just kind of assume.
Yeah.
The whole I love you, I know thing, classic.
Yep, very classic. Worked out well.
Fantastic.
Let's see, Lord of the Rings, romance, Arwen, buh.
Eowyn and Faramir is amazing in the book.
In the movie, it did not come across as great.
In the movie, it's like, hey, these two characters are supposed to be together.
And the Sam, let's again, have them, let's the have Sam, them, the Sam let's Frodo have them. Romance works out a lot better.
Yeah.
Man, our fandoms really are bad when it comes to relationships, probably because they're all written by men.
Well, let's look at one written by a woman, which has one of the greatest, I think one of the greatest sci-fi pairings.
Indeed. I think I know where you're going, but continue.
Which it would be the Vorkosigan saga.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Cordelia Naismith and Arl Vorkosigan.
And it's fascinating because you only really get their, like, full-blown relationship. Really, I'd say in one book. I mean,
and even that is a prequel, right? Like, that one was written later. And,
well, I'm even saying of the prequel, like, there's the two, right? Yeah. There's the one where they meet, and then there's the one where Miles is born.
Right.
And really, it's where they meet. And it's that, you know, they have the best, like, antagonistic, like, cliche antagonistic relationship, right?
They don't, because they forge quite an understanding fairly early on. Yeah. Okay, so it's the, I mean, without giving too much away, it's the classic, like, he's from the planet of Bari. I mean, we talked about this series so many times on the podcast, but he's from the...
Sort of militaristic.
Very militaristic, kind of imperialist Russian type planet. Yeah. And she is from...
Canada.
Future Canada. And, you know, she's on her first captaining, like her first expedition as a ship's captain, but they're basically a scientific explorer type vessel.
Yeah.
And they end up in...
There's a war going on and sort of she gets caught up in it and he takes her prisoner. But like, it's not like the standard like... You know, antagonist, like, oh, I hate you. I'll never wind up with a man like you.
No, they clearly like and respect each other. Like, it's basically love at first sight for him. Not even love at first sight for him. Kind of a weird, bizarre admiration at first sight.
Well, and the whole thing is undercut by the fact that they're dragging around this wounded companion of hers. Like, he... And it really, like...
He shot one of her lieutenants. Yeah. He shot with a nerve disruptor.
Yeah.
Which basically rendered him a vegetable. And from his perspective, they would just leave him behind because he's as good as dead. But from her perspective, he's still alive and he's part of her crew and she's responsible for him.
And so as like a military man, he respects the fact that she's looking after her you know, lieutenant, this person in charge. Yeah. But it undercuts it, right? It's like you're having, you know, that kind of like, oh, we're stranded together. We got to figure stuff out. But there's like this other presence.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that
defines their entire courtship through the book, right? It's just, it's constantly, they're never alone.
No.
They're all, even when she's taken to the prisoner of war camp and he like, sort of, they go off on that long walk where he essentially proposes to her.
Yeah.
They're still being shadowed by like.
The security
guards and stuff. So, I mean, it's very fascinating.
And their relationship is, it's very, it's this wonderful, like, powerful...
And very under... Like, there's just so much simmering under the surface.
And the fact that they're both older characters.
They're older. They have previous relationships.
When Lois McBastor-Bujold is writing, like, middle-aged characters, they are amazing. And the romances between these middle-aged characters is just perfect.
Well, I think because they're not overly idealistic.
No.
There's a sort of lived...
They're not simpering.
I mean, what I love is that when... So they meet, they go through these various survival experiences, they end up on opposite sides of a war, they kind of go through all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And finally end up together, finally get married, she gets pregnant, complications arise with that.
Yeah.
Leading, you know, and they get wrapped up in a civil war on his home world. And what I like is there's actually, I forget how exactly it's stated, but there is a moment where Cordelia is basically thinking that they would, like, their marriage would dissolve if it weren't for Miles.
Yeah.
If it weren't for the fact that they have this child.
Yeah.
Or... you know,
yes,
child in a uterine replicator waiting to be born.
Yes,
they that's what is keeping them together. Like that is in that moment. That's really the only thing keeping them together, and because there's just too much
happening
around them. And I like that there is that there's tension, there's bickering, it's not just a
perfect relationship that, yeah, that weathers all storms.
Yeah, and I think because both of them came to the relationship really severely burned off of other relationships.
Well, yeah, with a lot of pain, a lot going on.
That they're both horribly scarred. I mean, he more so than her, arguably. But neither of them are overly romantic.
No, well, they're not. They're lived-in characters. You know, they don't just feel like, you know, 20-somethings that have just people been like, oh, they're 40. But
well, and it's also not that ideal of romance that's wholly... I mean, I think that there can be a sort of romantic ideal that's very much about self-gratification, yes. Right? What can I get into this out of this? How can I be fulfilled? And that romantic notion that's built up through romantic comedies and I think what's great about the story of Cordelia and Arl is it's very much not that.
No,
it's very much a giving of self to the other.
Well, and two people who are just used to the notion of sacrifice and have really strong ideas of sacrifice, and they become very powerful background characters for the rest of the series.
Well, and that's what's so amazing, right? Is you just get the two books that are kind of published as one.
Yeah. Cordelia's Honor.
But with Shards of Honor and Bariar.
Yeah.
So depending on how you've read them. But with the exception of that, they really are minor background characters in the story of their son.
Well, I mean,
maybe not minor, I mean, but
Arl Vorkosigan is essentially like a piece of geography, right? I mean, he's just this giant looming force, and so is she, but in a much more sort of subtler way.
Yeah.
Like, you know, for the sort of the direct military kind of history kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know, the Arl Vorkosigan really plays this big prominent part, but like everyone sort of any point of view character very quickly comes to understand how powerful Cordelia is, and I wanted to at least touch on Miles. Miles has a lot of unfortunate relationships, but it really is not until towards the end that he does have a great relationship. And again, it's a relationship after he's had a bunch of other ones, after she's come through.
Well, I mean, she's a widow,
yeah,
and with a child,
and that I think really really helps, because in the other the other series of hers that I really enjoy, Paladin of Souls and Curse of Chalion. The characters there that I like are older characters.
Well, I think it's this idea that, again, you know, to have some substance to this conversation outside of just
who we like and who we don't like.
I think it's the idea of you bring yourself to a relationship
with
all of your baggage, both good and bad. And I think that the relationship, she writes romantic relationships very well when she has that element in it.
Yeah.
And I think the relationships that fall flat, namely in the Sharing Knife books or
Captain Vorkosigan.
Yeah, the most recent Vorkosigan saga, which is about Miles's cousin Ivan, they just that element is not there.
No.
And it makes the relationships much more shallow.
Well, yeah, and there's, I don't know, there's weird stuff that's the kind of the older guy with the younger girl kind of issue that comes up in a lot of stuff. And you would kind of hope that she would know a little better, or at least deal with better, but she doesn't.
Well, I mean, and Arl is older than Cordelia, but just by like 10 years and...
Well, and it's not...
And Cordelia's old enough that it doesn't matter.
It's not a 40-year-old and a 20-year-old. I think they're being like a 50-year-old and a 40-year-old is a little different. Or 45 and 35, whatever it is. So that's kind of... And it's a weird power dynamic too, right? Mm-hmm. That's the real issue with some of those books, is there's just like this weird,
power dynamic. Yeah.
I mean, that's, I don't know. I think that would presumably be the problem with kind of some of the weirder Austinian or mm-hmm. older books there, where you've got these older men looking after. What's the one where he like dandles her on his knee? Isn't there like one of the creepier versions of Sense and Sensibility? Or
I think there's a version of Emma.
Oh, okay.
That I used to argue with one of my roommates about. She really liked it because it was like the one from like the 80s, the BBC one from the 80s. And the Mr. Knightley is just so creepily old.
Oh, okay.
And it's a little, it's just...
Doesn't work.
It just creeps me out. Whereas really like in Jane Austen's era, old is not really that old. Like Colonel Brandon in Sense and Sensibility is like 35.
Oh, okay.
You know, so admittedly 35 and like 17 is a little sketchy, but it's not like... It's not like in Emma. It's not like that version of Emma where Emma's marrying like a 50-year-old guy.
It's not like the sad Downton Abbey where the second sister tries to like seduce the the poor like guy with a cane.
Yeah. Have anything else about Bujold?
No, I mean I think Bujold does a wonderful job, and with lived-in characters. It's really only these slightly more shallower ones where things kind of fall flat. And again, with Vorpichil's alliance, the main female in that was just such a...
But I'm comfortable enough with myself to say that I'm a big girl's blouse, and I go back and I reread Cordelia's Honor and A Civil Campaign over and over and over
again.
Well, they're so great, and the romance... Like, I am such a sucker for good romance.
You are.
It took me a long time to come to terms with it, because I was sort of embarrassed by that.
You do ship.
I am a shipper. Oh, gosh darn, I'm a shipper. But at least I'm like a canon shipper. I'm not like a... crazy fanfic.
Trying to, like, smash together people who don't belong together.
Yeah, who just have no...
What was the weird... I couldn't even follow it, but there was the weird, like, controversy over J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter. Oh,
that's because Harry Potter fan... Well, let me just say. So I'm a giant shipper, and I just reread Cordelia's Honor and A Civil Campaign over and over again. Yes. Because...
They're amazing.
They make my little heart flutter. No... So Ron and Hermione get together in the books.
With bad mustaches.
And I guess in Harry Potter fandom, there are those who feel this is a great travesty against Hermione's character, why she would end up with the goofball Ron, and believe she needed to be with Harry.
Okay.
And I guess J.K. Rowling said... This quote got around of J.K. Rowling saying that Hermione and Ron should not have been together.
Okay.
Which then led everyone going, like, articles were written saying, J.K. Rowling said Hermione should have been with Harry, which she didn't actually say in the quote at all. And if you actually go back and, I guess, like, MuggleNet or some, I don't know, I saw someone on Facebook posted some fuller article from one of these Harry Potter sites that had, like, the full interview in which... J.K. Rowling actually said that, like, in the quote made sense in context.
Yeah.
Saying that she is her as a sort of bookish woman, identify with Hermione and wanted Hermione to have someone, so paired her up with Ron.
Okay.
Because like really, she and Harry didn't work together. There was no. There was no reason for them to be together, and.
I find most of the romantic relationships in those books.
Of course, they're
sketchy to begin with.
Harry and Ginny never made sense to me. It just felt like I don't know. Harry got together with Ron's younger sister.
Yes.
Anyway, so she was saying that like Hermione and Ron probably would have had a difficult time of a relationship and will probably end up needing to be in counseling. And but at the same time, she was saying that there is something about those. We don't know anything about this in our relationship. There's something about those overly driven, like really intense women who need like a funny guy to help them not take themselves so seriously. And
I see. Interesting.
So that they that was there. So anyway, the larger context of J.K. Rowling's article made sense. It wasn't just her going back and like retconning her own stories, which it made me so annoyed when she came out and said that Dumbledore was gay.
Well, it was just
because I feel like she wanted to have her cake and eat it too.
Yeah,
she wanted to be like, I'm so progressive for having Dumbledore be gay. It isn't that great, without it actually being in the books to potentially harm the sales.
Yeah,
and I know several like
well, people were really upset.
Were really upset because it like just gave into a gay stereotype of like the,
well, and so many folks were expecting Tonks and Lupin to like felt identified with Tonks and Lupin.
Yeah,
like felt like they were telling an interesting story, and then
we're
gonna put them together. Yeah.
So I felt like I felt like with the Dumbledore thing, she was just trying to like get the publicity after the book had already made massive sales without the potential of any fallout from it. So I felt like it was a very cowardly thing to do.
No,
I thought this was just another way of her like trying to stay in the public spotlight by saying this thing that she knew would outrage her fans. But I think in hindsight, the whole thing made more sense. We are really digressing.
It's very true. And I'm going to do a double back because I want to, this will tickle Tom, because we once found someone's fan site for their like dream casting.
Oh, I remember that.
Of the Vorpommersagen saga. And it was Gillian Anderson as Cordelia. And we were like, okay, that makes David sense. Red haired. And then David Duchovny. David Duchovny as Errol, and we were suddenly very suspicious.
Your laughter is stirring our child.
Killer Doll Eyes is our code for when our daughter's eyes pop open. She'll be very quiet, and you won't know that she's awake or that she's stirring, and then you'll look down, and they'll be staring up at you. Now, for me, the big thing that I like gushed over as a shipper would probably have to be Tim and Dawn.
It's true.
Tim and Dawn, that whole thing really was so well done.
I want to interrupt you for a second and just say that I imagine for the rest of this conversation we're going to be talking exclusively about television.
Yeah.
Cuz I think it's book series, and it's hard, I think, to do like really good romance just in one movie.
John Cusack can do it.
It's true. But I think it's we're talking about relationships that are able to span and develop precisely. And have up ebbs and flows and all of that kind of
No, I think stuff. That's, I think it's very true. Well, and it's also
more fodder for conversation.
And also it's easy to compare stuff too, right? You know, kind of seeing relationships form or seeing them kind of like go static and stale.
I just think you're able to do that more interestingly in TV. Than...
Yeah, certainly. But I feel like with the British Office, they managed to tell an amazing story that was very rich. And they told it in very few words. And I think there's a lot to be said about that.
Well, it's done in just, small looks and what's not said.
And a touch here, a touch there. And it's, and literally in what's not said. I mean, one of the most beautiful moments was that season two scene where he takes off the microphone and takes off her microphone. And they go into the room, and the camera kind of like follows them,
and you sort of see them, but you can't hear them.
And then he comes back out, notices the camera, picks up his mic, and says, "She said no." And it was so beautiful
and so painful,
and just absolutely wonderful. And then during the Christmas special, I know I've talked about this before.
This is getting into spoiler territory.
Getting into spoiler territory for
10-year-old show.
But, you know, when she came back to the party at that last moment, I was watching that with Jackson O'Brien, and I just wailed on him with the pillow I had been clutching, because we got into this huge thing about, like she has to come back. The relationship has to work. He's like, no, it's not going to happen, okay? He's just, you know, it's just, it can't happen. He's just giving that big speech about, like, you know, life moving on. And then she was back and it was great. But then you pointed out that big speech about life moving on undercuts.
And you don't know what's going to happen the next day.
That spoils that whole moment. But it didn't, because it was beautiful. And I depended on Stephen Merchant being a big girl's blouse. And he totally was.
It is true. That relationship, and I think it has so much more poignancy because Martin Freeman just is so pluckily pitiful.
It's very true. description for him.
He just he's not so pitiful that he just feels sorry for himself and and makes you want to, you know, chuck him out a window.
Yeah.
He has like enough gumption that he will sort of.
Well, he's cheeky,
right? He has enough gumption that he wants something more than what he has.
Yeah.
But he also is realistic enough to know that he's probably not going to get it.
No, it's he's a very wonderful everyman.
Yeah.
And so and so to see that relationship just and again to see it contrasted with Jim and Pam.
I mean, I think it's not fair because we should only judge it up until when Jim and Pam get together.
That's very true. But even I feel like even before.
Yeah.
It was a different relationship. And again, because they had to film more episodes and they had to space it out more. I feel like
with Jim and Pam, it was whenever they actually in those early seasons, whenever they actually did have a serious conversation, I always felt like it sort of somehow fell flat.
Yeah.
And I think because they actually did try to script that dialogue, as opposed to how The Office played so much understated, so much it was so much more conscious of being filmed.
Yeah.
And they were, I felt like the characters were always more conscious of being on screen.
No, that
they
a lot
did
of
have to, they did have to sort of play things with much greater subtlety. Like that moment when Tim and Dawn kiss in the comic relief episode.
Oh, it's so good.
When she's like selling kisses for a quid.
Oh.
And he sort of gets cajoled into buying a kiss. And I mean, that's one of the best on-screen kisses. And it's so short. It's barely more than a peck. But the amount of, like...
What they communicate in that?
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, so good. So that's the best one. Now let's talk about some of the worst. Let's talk about Lois and Clark.
That was not a worst one. It was just the way it sort of...
petered out.
Well, I mean, the romance didn't peter out necessarily. It just became very self-involved. Like, it became a show that was all about the romance.
Yeah.
Instead of having this nice romantic undercurrent.
Yeah.
To it. I mean, I think that's something to what makes a good romance in a show. And sometimes it's the romance on the side as opposed to the main story. So I think a great example of this is Lost.
Oh, okay.
Where...
Because you love Kate so much.
I so could not care. I can't... There is nothing I cared less about than Kate, Jack, and Sawyer. In fact, I was so happy when Sawyer gave up on Kate altogether and got together with Juliet.
Yeah.
Because that was a great relationship. And then Jack and Kate could just go off and be self-involved, and that was fantastic. But Desmond and Penny.
Yeah.
Gosh darn Desmond and Penny.
You'd love those two.
Oh my goodness. I think there got to be a point where I was solely watching Lost for Hurley and for Desmond and Penny.
That works.
But that was a relationship that just carried like the emotional weight of the show. And it was you know, Saeed had some great relationships, but he was like kind of in love with a new person every season.
Okay.
But Desmond and Penny just carried so much weight, and they were, from the moment Desmond is introduced, he cares about nothing but Penny. And then you meet Penny, and she's much more than just a love interest for Desmond. She is an agent of her own. She is out there looking for him.
Yeah.
She is responsible for getting them off the island. She is, maybe I should have done spoiler alerts for that. It's Lost. But she is... She is an agent, and she's not just...
No.
Yeah. It's not just we were introduced with this character who's really great, and he has a woman who's up on a pedestal somewhere who is not really a fully formed person in her own right, but they were equally in love with each other and committed to finding one another. And I think it's another great example of relationships that, like, had its ups and downs of Desmond walking out on Penny and... Penny being angry at him, but refusing to let him go fully, and
it was fascinating just amazing. Because they were not really primary characters.
Not at all.
The primary characters were Anoy,
mm-hmm.
and they weren't Hurley.
Yeah.
But you also, for a while, I didn't watch a ton of Lost, but I really liked the Jin and Sun.
Oh, dynamic. Absolutely.
I thought that was a
well. I think it's these relationships that are lived in that feel. Believable, and that I think, again, have ups and downs that aren't just melodramatic,
yeah.
but feel like you know, you can understand Jin and Sun. You can understand this guy from a poor fishing village who falls in love with this very wealthy girl and wants her at any cost and sort of ends up doing things like you must love this story because he sacrifices everything yeah. to get her, and then that drives him away. That drives her away from him.
That is my favorite kind of story.
But yeah, so I think it's again, sometimes it's the B characters or the beta couple, as they would call it on TV tropes, that can actually carry more, that can carry the more interesting story. So I could not get through this entire podcast without talking about what you know I have to talk about.
I know. Get it out of your system. I know. Mulder and Scully.
But no, I think Farscape is a great example of one of the only times that I have really loved the primary couple on a show.
Yeah.
Usually I find it just gets overdone.
They're so in each other's business.
They're in each other's business, or they just string it out. Like, the will they, won't they just get strung out too long.
Yeah.
I think with the relationship between John and Aaron in Farscape, it's amazing how it built. Like, it's constantly moving. It's never static, right? It manages to constantly progress. Like, they find ways to keep it progressing without undermining the tension. And I think that's a real tribute to the actors and the writers who were really, really super invested in that relationship. And especially the Ben Browder, who played John Crichton, I've heard him talk in interviews about how he would get really frustrated at this idea that you can't get these two characters together, because once you get the characters together, all the tension's gone.
Yeah.
And he's someone who has actually had like a long-standing and successful marriage. And he's like, you get two people in a marriage, that doesn't mean the tension goes away. the tension actually increases. And you know, I feel like Farscape is an example of a show where you actually get to see that play out a little bit.
Well, then
actually get to see the character. To some degree, you actually get to see the characters together in an established relationship.
Well, and didn't the actors decide to undercut the whole will they, won't they? Well,
especially early on. Especially early on, they joked that they were just playing all of these scenes of Crichton and Aaron going off to have sex together.
Yes.
even though it was not written in and the writers did not approve. But they established that these two characters slept together in the first season.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, like, that's what I love about it, is that they took the very bold move of establishing, yes, there is something between these two. Is it just physical attraction at this point? Who knows? Who knows what it has the ability to progress into, but that they allowed there to be movement in that relationship all the way through the show. It wasn't just held in we need to have sexual tension for the sake of sexual tension.
Yeah.
And I love that it's actually about, I mean, again, the writers talk about Farscape as a show that is about family.
Yeah.
You know, and it's about creating a life and a family in an alien world. And so in that sense, you know, wormholes and everything else, the Skerrans and the Peacekeepers and all of that going on is just the backdrop and the setting for a love story. And I like it that, you know, even Brian Henson has talked about Farscape as primarily a romance.
Okay.
That's the genre in some ways that he sees it primarily fitting into. And so in that sense, the whole Crichton and Aaron thing isn't just, you know,
tacked on. It's
the central. Tacked on. You need a love story because, you know, you have to have this sexual tension. It is. Farscape is the story of John and Aaron.
Yeah.
And I think part of why it works is that in some ways, Aaron's trajectory and Aaron's character growth is actually the most interesting story in Farscape.
Yeah.
So it is really the story of these two people, both alienated from their worlds, finding a life and finding somehow to make a life with each other, stripped of everything else that they have. And it's another relationship where you see, you know, ups and downs. And our dog is very loud.
Yeah, we apologize for that. This is the problem of trying to podcast away from him, is he's not as loud, but he is more
in the background.
Now, a TV show that we watched that probably had more relationships than actual characters was Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, gosh darn. Do we have to talk about
it? A soap opera in space.
Do we have to talk about Battlestar Galactica?
I feel like we should talk about it because I want to talk about at least the primary relationship. I'm going to say the primary relationship. There's 1,000 relationships and most of them are awful.
Baltar and Head Six.
Baltar and Head. Okay. That's the one like healthy relationship was Baltar and Head Virus Six. No, I want to talk very briefly at least and touch on Rosalyn and Adama.
Yes.
Because on one hand, I feel like it was the most interesting relationship.
Oh, very much so.
It got weird towards the end.
Rosalyn got terrible and whatever her name was who played...
Oh, Mary McDonnell.
Mary McDonnell got way too much Botox.
Either she got way too much Botox or something really awful happened.
Yeah. Because she forgot how to emote.
And...
Or mostly just her mouth forgot how to move.
Yeah, that got stranger and stranger. But I was thinking about this. I was thinking about whether, because at the time I really liked it. I thought that was like the characters I really liked seeing together and seeing their kind of the power struggle that they were going between. You know, we were joking about the sort of the fan shipping with Mulder and Scully as Errol and Cordelia. But really, if I were to look for any models, it would be those two as Errol and Cordelia. But it also got me wondering if there's a problem of shows where you have these two strong primary characters of them sort of having to have a romantic relationship. Like, would Battlestar Galactica have been successful or, like, would we have enjoyed it as much if they had just been two people struggling and fighting and working out and having a relationship but without them having to have this sort of...
But I feel like the relationship with Rosalyn and Adama came along... It was
gradual. I mean...
So late, right? That you did... And arguably came was expressed once the show had already jumped the shark.
Well, yeah.
So the best seasons of Battlestar Galactica were without that relationship really doing anything more than simmering his potential in the background.
But I guess that's the problem.
Not a lot of attention paid to it.
I suppose.
In that time, it was much more about, like, Starbuck and Adama. That's true. And Apollo. Lee and,
yeah.
Which I never... I mean, I think this is an interesting conversation, is, like, when taking a relationship in a romantic direction is actually not what you need to do.
No.
Like, I never bought the romantic tension between Apollo and Starbuck.
Do we buy the romantic potential of Starbuck and anyone?
No,
who not weird, really. Like baseball boyfriend?
Yeah, husband. Sorry. They got married.
Oh, right.
I guess to like spite Lee or something. I don't even know. That weird love quadrangle that ended up there eventually. But I thought they had a good sibling chemistry. I liked that about them.
Yeah.
And I felt like the romantic stuff just was not...
No, it just didn't.
Wasn't necessary. And again, I say this, I'm a shipper. I like my kissies.
Did anyone on that show have a relationship?
Billy and Dee?
Oh, Billy. man alive was I sad about that.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's, I feel like just so many of the relationships on BSG detracted from the story.
No, I think that's incredibly fair. And now a series or a couple of... Oh, sorry, yes.
Oh, I was going to say, I think Fringe is an interesting example of a show that could have gone either way with the love story. I could have taken Fringe without any romantic relationship between Peter and Olivia.
Yeah.
But I don't think it detracts from the story when it emerged.
Okay.
Because originally, I mean, you could almost say that Peter and Olivia had almost a sibling-like relationship.
Well, they're both so unlikable.
They're not unlikable. Not once you get to know them. I love Fringe.
I know you love Fringe.
But, I mean, I could have been okay with the show as much as, again, I like romantic, like, I like the romantic aspects of shows. I could have handled Fringe and liked Fringe just as much if they'd chosen to not have any romantic storyline at all.
That's fair.
But that said, I do think the way it plays out is done well. And I think it becomes a very good and interesting relationship. I don't want to say too much because I know that our friend Rachel is listening and I know that she's like only, you know, 2/3 of the way through season 3.
Fair enough.
So I don't want to say too much, but I like the way, you know, it's interesting shows like Farscape or Fringe where you have this central relationship where there comes a point where there's no reason to not have the characters together, and it's really unbelievable that the characters wouldn't be together anymore.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see the creative kind of leaps they have to go through to acknowledge that this relationship now exists, but still kind of throw a monkey wrench into it. And I feel like Lois and Clark tried to do that.
And failed.
With the stupid frog clones.
Oh, I don't talk about frog clones.
In season 3 when they were supposed to get married. And then the whole amnesia storyline. But it just was really, really, really stupid and they didn't buy it. I think Fringe and Farscape handled it a little bit better.
Do you know what random show from the 90s had a relationship that I really liked? Although I don't even think I watched the show that much.
Touched by an Angel.
No. Okay. No. No.
The Mountie Show. The love of a Mountie and his wolf.
I
mentioned I had a glass of wine tonight.
I was going to say Northern Exposure.
Oh, really?
I really liked Joel and his little short hair.
I didn't
girlfriend.
Watch Northern Exposure.
It suddenly popped in. I was like trying to think of like shows that had relationships that I just liked seeing. And for some reason, that popped in my head. Very strange. I don't know why. No, what I wanted to touch on, because I think it's vital and we're quickly approaching an hour.
Are we? Our shows are getting so much longer.
Buffy and Angel.
Oh.
Both as shows and as characters.
Do I have to talk about Buffy and Angel? Do I have to acknowledge Buffy and Angel?
No, I'm just saying Buffy and Angel as shows and as a relationship, because I think your response to that, because Buffy was also one of these like serial monogamists who would like bounce around and have pretty odious relationship. Did she have any like healthy, good relationships that you liked at all? No, by your blankness?
No. Well, I think it's a problem of the A relationship just isn't that interesting, right?
No.
It's a problem of Buffy and Angel were just too steeped in melodrama and too, like, just obsessed with their own.
But Angel, it was interesting. I found that Angel's main relationship with Cordelia.
Well, I think this is where we're getting into controversial territory.
Oh, are we? Okay.
Well, I mean, I think you and I agree.
Yeah.
I think the internet might not agree with us.
Okay.
I've read many different perspectives
because I like this. Sort
I of... liked Cordelia and Angel.
Yeah, I like them a lot, and I like their relationship.
Well, here's what I remember is I remember when we were in college.
Yeah.
Our friend Tom.
I was there.
Were you? our friend Tom, hi Tom, talking about Cordelia and Angel and mentioning that Angel had fallen in love with Cordelia. And at this point, I had just started watching Buffy.
Oh, I see.
And I was like, that is crazy talk. I am never watching Angel. That show is absurd. I do not buy it. No. And then, I mean, obviously Angel would not be in love with Cordelia as she was in Sunnydale, but the Cordelia that she turns into.
Yeah.
I mean, she goes through such a wonderful character transformation as being the person who can call him out on his issues and yet offer this sense. I mean, in some ways, offer the same thing Buffy offered him, this sense of life and vitality and joy that he didn't have. I love the way it gets acknowledged and realized, if not ever consummated.
Yeah, well, and that's what I was going to get at, was that I liked that part of it as well.
Because it wasn't an unrequited love.
No. But it was an interesting simmering relationship.
Yeah.
Of all the relationships on both Buffy and Angel, which is your favorite?
Oh.
Of all those permutations. Because I think the Fred Wesley relationship.
Yeah, it would have to be Wesley and Fred or Willow and Oz.
Mm. Oh, okay. Speaking of controversy, isn't the sort of the Willow? Wasn't Anya supposed to have like erased all of the Ozziness?
You mean Tara?
Sorry, Tara. Yes.
Well, I think it's the people who are. I think there is some concern that Willow's clearly bisexual in season 4 and gay in season 5.
Oh, I see. I got you.
And I think there's some
issue with that.
Issue with the inability to recognize bisexuality in media, blah, 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 blah. But no, as a relationship, I think, I mean, it's, you just love Oz.
Yeah. You know?
But I, Seth Green. I think, yeah. But in some ways, maybe Oz was too good for Willow.
The Fred.
But the Fred Wesley relationship, I love it from the unrequited love standpoint. Yeah. I love how
they kept sort of missing each other for
a while. They just kept missing each other. I love what happens in season 3 of Angel when Wesley is so isolated and alienated from everyone.
Yeah.
Largely because of Fred and Gunn's relationship.
Yeah.
And that leads him to his betrayal of Angel.
Oh, gosh darn.
Lovely, lovely pain is only Joss Whedon can provide us.
True enough.
And I don't like what happens to Fred in order to elicit reactions from the men.
Oh, okay.
It's sort of, she gets a little refrigerated.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I don't like that aspect of it, but fair, I think, enough. It's an ongoing saga. But I guess my frustration is it's more about Wesley than about Fred.
Oh, okay.
More about Wesley's feelings and Wesley's pining after her. And I feel like she...
And Gunn's weird, like, ownership of her.
Yeah, and I feel like Wesley finally just gets Fred only in order to cause pain.
Okay.
As Joss Whedon interesting. Does. Well, no, if we're talking about... Yes. We're talking about Whedon relationships. We have to go outside of the Buffyverse and say Zoe and Wash.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the best relationship in
No, it's very true. In Joss Again, Whedon. The best lived-in relationship.
Yeah. With all of its, you know, are they a healthy relationship? I think at the end of the day, yeah, they probably were. But they certainly had their conflicts and their fights and...
Well, again, they just felt like real people.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, like, whatever fights they had were real fights, even if they were kind of over...
Well, you can see the way, you know, the fights, Wash's jealousy of Mal.
Yeah.
Even though there was nothing between Zoe and Mal, you could still see why he would be jealous of the respect she showed him.
Yeah.
It wasn't really a sexual thing at all.
No.
You know, just the cabin fever that would set in. I mean, it made a lot of sense.
It does make a lot of sense. All right. I feel like we've come a good full circle. We've taken a nice tour of our fandoms and seen what works with love and what doesn't.
Any other... I feel like I have to mention the Sheridan-Delin relationship.
Oh, right.
I feel like it's another really good, like, ongoing relationship that is a rare example of... I think probably because it wasn't the central aspect of the show.
I guess.
It was a fairly minor
storyline. I sort of felt like it kind of crept in. And
well, it did. I mean,
towards the end.
I guess so.
The end of that fourth season, whatever.
Yeah. Blah, blah, blah. Only more at the beginning of the fourth season when Delin is just like pining after John and...
Oh, I see. Okay.
Threatening to die if he doesn't come back from Zahadoom. Oh, and good. her whole strong character is like warrior... Priest, diplomat, like leader of the Minbari people, gets completely undermined by pining after John and just sort of Johnning a lot.
Fair enough.
But I feel like by the middle of the fourth season, they kind of
got over that.
She wakes up again. But I think because it wasn't like a show about them,
you were
able to just see this relationship naturally progress. And there are two things I really like about it. One is that you do see this really a really gradual progression of it building up very slowly in season 2 and only becoming sort of explicit late in season 3. And you're actually able to see them eventually get married.
Yes.
And be an established couple.
After her sad little assistant has to watch them do it.
That was such a bad episode. I think that's it's a rare example of where you get to see a primary ship actually get established. But for a whole they're married for a whole season, right? But So it's rare you get to see that and then and just be married. And I also like the fact that they are still very independent. They still, even in their marriage, even when they're running the Interstellar Alliance together, they each have their own agendas.
Okay.
They have their own agendas. They have their own stuff that they're doing. And I think it, again, creates a much more lived-in relationship because there's just too much more important going on in the overarching story for them to be completely subsumed by their own relation. Also, it's another example of they're older, right? So they wouldn't be as believable as completely self-involved lovers,
in each other's
right?
business, yeah.
Yeah. They just have too much else to pay attention to for it to be all about them.
Yeah.
And so even though they do have this really, really strong connection and you believe that, I mean, I guess there are some people who find the relationship not particularly...
Well, it's nowhere near as beautiful as the love shared between Jakar and Londo,
of course.
So.
But I think it's interesting that just they do have different agendas. They have their own stuff that they are pursuing.
Yeah,
and I think it's an interesting. I don't feel like you get to see many relationships like that are so established, that are written to be so. Integral to the storyline and integral to the characters, and is played as like this really cosmic
souls
brought together by the power of the universe and all of that, and yet they still have perspective.
They still have their stuff to do.
They still have to run the galaxy, and you know,
there we go.
And I like that.
Excellent. Okay.
So on that note, anything else?
I think we've done it. I think we've looked at what's amazing and good in our various respective fans. Obviously, there's a lot out there that we haven't touched upon. The strange relationship between Vimes and his lovely little wife.
Oh, we didn't talk about Vimes and Lady Sybil. I like Vimes and Lady Sybil.
Again, older couples.
Older couples.
Getting together.
Well, here's... I'm waiting to see what happens with Sleepy Hollow.
Oh, yeah.
I really don't get the, like... Ichabod Abbey shipping out there.
It's this thing I'm touching on, right? The fact that when you have a show where these two people are together, there's this weird expectation for romance.
But I don't feel... But he's married to a woman trapped in purgatory.
Hey, when the cat's away in purgatory.
Anyway, I'm really interested to see, like... It could go either way at this point for me. I feel like in order for the relationship to be... believable, they would have to really, either his wife is going to have to be totes evil or she's going to have to die some horrible death. But at the moment, can't we just enjoy their friend chemistry? Because they have really good friend chemistry.
Is it as good as the chemistry you find on Once Upon a Time?
And sorry, for those of you who are not privy to the crazy Facebook conversation I had today.
Oh, dearie dear.
On that note.
Okay. We're going to be taken out. We've sort of burned through, I think, a lot of the romance songs of Debs and Errol. So I'm going to play a very sweet song of theirs. I believe Falling Quickly. I want to say it's Tetris related. I'm not 100% sure. Mm. But you will like it.
Will
I? I meant the listeners. Oh. Okay. But I guess you will like it too. Do you even listen to our podcast, Rachel?
Why would I listen to our
something so many of our listeners say?
When I was in CPE, my supervisor had to sit next to me and force me to watch my like sermon videos. I hate listening to myself that much.
Well then.
On that note.
Love. From the world of faith, family, and fandom. Never in any particular order.
I don't even know anymore.
Usually with dog barkings.
And killer doll eyes.
We are Geekfully Yoked. Enjoy Debs and Errol. Geek out, y'all.